Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Inside Politics. I'm John King in Washington. Very busy news day. Thank you for your time. Can the House Speaker keep his members in line? The debt deal meets its first test today in the House Rules Committee, where hardline conservatives, deeply unhappy with the agreement, have a chance to kill it. Plus, drones deep behind enemy lines. An attack in Moscow brings the Ukraine war directly into the heart of Russia's capital as Vladimir Putin keeps up a relentless aerial assault on Kyiv. And Ron DeSantis makes his first big road trip as an official presidential candidate. Three cities in 12 early voting states just this week, beginning tonight as DeSantis courts evangelicals in Iowa. But up first for us, the deal to pull the United States back from a debt cliff meets its first big roadblock today. At 3 p.m., the House Rules Committee convenes. It is TBD whether the unhappy conservatives on that panel will have enough votes to try to kill the Biden-McCarthy debt pact at its first legislative stop. Hardliners say the deal that gave Speaker McCarthy the gavel back in January included a promise that any legislation needed all nine Republican Rules Committee votes to make it to the full House. McCarthy allies say they don't remember it that way. This Washington wrinkle puts the must-pass deal in some considerable early peril. The hardliners say the compromise doesn't cut enough spending. But listen to Speaker McCarthy this morning. He says he got the better of the president and the Republicans should vote yes.
We're actually going to spend less money this year than we spent last year. Read the Wall Street Journal. They say it's a very good bill. This is the biggest cut in American history that we'd vote for. I'm not quite sure what else they want to go. I think we got to look at where the victories are. We don't spend another $4 trillion. We allow them to keep going forward until January.
Let's get straight up to Capitol Hill. CNN's Melanie Zanona is live for us there. Melanie, the speaker says Republicans should vote for it, but he's got some trouble on his hands.
Yeah, that's right. There is a lot of outrage on the right here over this deal. They feel like he essentially gave up too much in these negotiations. And the House Freedom Caucus is actually holding a press conference right now to rally opposition against this bill. But, John, the two big questions right now are, do they have the votes to be able to block this from even coming to the floor or passing on the floor? And is Kevin McCarthy's speakership safe? Now, on the first question, it does not appear that they do have the power to block this. The bill does have to go through the House Rules Committee later today before it can get a floor vote. And there are three hardline conservatives on that panel. That was part of the deal that Kevin McCarthy made to become speaker. But two of them, Ralph Norman and Chip Roy, are signaling they will vote against the rule. But one of them, Thomas Massie, we are learning, is expected to support the rule, which means it will be able to advance and get onto the floor. But on that second question, John, whether Kevin McCarthy's speakership is safe, that is a lot less clear. The House Freedom Caucus did have a call last night where they talked about their strategy moving forward and how they're going to approach this. And while a lot of them are against the idea of using a tool known as the motion to vacate, which would essentially force a floor vote on ousting Kevin McCarthy, it only takes one member to be able to force that vote. And Congressman Chip Roy is especially angry. He told Glenn Beck in an interview on the radio moments ago that this deal is a betrayal of the power sharing agreement that we put in place among House Republicans. And he also said, if we can't kill this bill, then we're going to have to regroup and figure out the whole leadership arrangement again. So a clear threat there, John, and potentially his speakership at risk.
Mel, stand by because Chip Roy, you just mentioned, speaking right now. Let's listen.
The things that we actually run on, actually trying to change this place, actually trying to secure the border, actually saying that if you're going to raise the debt ceiling, maybe you should actually enact fiscal reforms to do so. We did that. We worked in good faith. Everybody's sitting around, working around the table to accomplish the objectives the American people sent here to do. Unfortunately, last week, there was a breach. There was a breach in the structure that we agreed to put in place to make sure that we are representing the American people through this heretofore United Republican Conference. The Republican Conference right now has been torn asunder. And we are working hard to try to put it back together again this weekend by making sure that this bill gets stopped. I want to be very clear. Not one Republican should vote for this deal.
Yes.
Not one. If you're out there watching this, every one of my colleagues, be very clear. Not one Republican should vote for this deal. It is a bad deal. No one sent us here to borrow an additional $4 trillion to get absolutely nothing in return. But at best, if I'm being really generous, a spending freeze for a couple of years. That's it. That's about what you get. And frankly, you're going to make things worse. And my Democratic colleagues know it. That's why they're supporting it. Mm-hmm. That's why they're going around gleeful. Look, there's a reason our Democrat colleagues support this. There's a reason that Mitt Romney supports this. There's a reason that Bill Kristol supports this. It's all the same stuff. There's a reason that our conservative allies are opposing it roundly. The Club for Growth scoring against it. The Heritage Foundation scoring against it. Freedom Works scoring against it. Ron DeSantis publicly opposed. President Trump said he thought we should default rather than pursue this kind of lunacy. At the end of the day, the only person that would default in this town is Joe Biden, unless Republicans default on the American dream by voting for this bad bill. That is why this.
You're listening to Congressman Chip Roy of Texas. You see members of the Freedom Caucus, the House Freedom Caucus, surrounding him. Kevin McCarthy had to negotiate with them to become Speaker, and now Chip Roy right there threatening that if this debt deal, the Speaker cut with the Biden White House, if it is passed, he's threatening to revisit the Speaker's hold on the gavel. With me in studio to share the reporting and their insights, CNN's Dana Bash, CNN's Nia Malika Henderson, and Sungmin Kim of the Associated Press. So there you have it right there. Number one, McCarthy appears to have the votes at the moment to get it out of the Rules Committee. Mm-hmm. The question is, as he sits in the Speaker's office, what calculations are going through his mind? Does he also think he can survive a challenge to his leadership, or does he have to yet again accommodate the right and stop his own deal?
That would be really remarkable, because this is the most delicate of balancing acts that both leaders in both parties have to do. The president is doing the same thing. It's just that maybe they haven't been as vocal this morning as they have been in the past with the left flank. And what we're talking about here is a true compromise, in the sense that there are, if all goes as planned from the perspective of the White House and the House Speaker, there will be no votes on the left, and there will be no votes on the right. And they're going to need the majorities to be gotten basically in the middle by Democrats and Republicans. The Chip Roys of the world are furious. Obviously, you just heard him say that. I spoke to a senior Republican House member this morning who said that the feeling among the House leadership is that there are not enough people who want to, quote unquote, emasculate their leaders, both the president and the speaker, in order to take this down. We'll see if that holds.
Right. So a traditional Washington deal, the left and the right are mad. You have enough votes in the middle, you pass it. Everybody grumbles and you move on. What makes this more interesting is just because Speaker McCarthy, House Republicans adopted the rule, one person, and Chip Roy, sounds like it's going to be him. Yeah, he can change his mind. But he comes to the, let's say they pass this, and he comes to the floor at the end of the week, says, I want to vacate the chair. Is Kevin McCarthy, like John Boehner, like Paul Ryan, to feel, you know, essentially going to lose his job, different circumstances, but because of flack on the right?
Listen, I mean, this was always the fear. I mean, we all covered the 15 rounds and he finally made the speakership. And sort of the underlying story was, you know, how tenuous his grasp on the speakership was. And with this happening, you see Chip Roy's very strong words. He said, you know, the Republican conference has been torn asunder. Not one Republican should vote for this deal, he said. So he does look as he's at least setting himself up to be somebody who would try to get the speaker out of there. Can he bring others along? I mean, he certainly seemed to be having a call to arms there for other Republicans to vote no on this deal and say, you know, there's a reason why Democrats are happy with this deal. And so we'll see. I mean, this was always going to be a perilous time for Kevin McCarthy, and we see it playing out.
To your point about call for arms, it was quite interesting. Governor DeSantis did say over the weekend, if he were in the House, he would oppose this deal. He would vote against it. Donald Trump hasn't said anything. Mm-hmm. Chip Roy quoting what Donald Trump said in the CNN town hall before this deal was struck, that at some point they're going to default. I'm not president. I don't care. That was Trump's flippant. It was just a flippant attitude. I'm not president. I'm not going to get blamed. Go ahead and default. But Trump has said nothing. At this tenuous moment, Donald Trump has a lot of sway over House Republicans. If he were to say something, he could tip the scale either way, could he not?
He definitely could, which is why you hear Congressman Chip Roy bringing all of the outside opposition, whether it's conservative outside spending groups, whether it's what the former president said before this deal was finalized, whether it's Florida Governor Ron DeSantis trying to drum up opposition against this deal. And you do see how Speaker McCarthy at least has to go on a really aggressive public relations messaging offensive. You hear him saying over and over since this deal was announced that Democrats got no wins in this deal, which isn't quite accurate. But that is what he and his lieutenants have to say to try to convince. I mean, you were probably never going to get a Chip Roy on any sort of deal. Right. I think we're kind of missing that point. Right. But those people who are kind of teetering on the edge of a yes or no in the Republican conference, he really does have to work overdrive to convince them that this is the best deal that you can get with a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president. So and you're going to hear that a lot of over the next several
days. It's working as we speak.
Right. It's a traditional Washington deal. And again, in a normal world, Kevin McCarthy can lose the Freedom Caucus, 40 votes there, because the new Democrats, the centrist Democrats, have said they're for it. So the math there works. Everybody goes away. Nobody's happy, but you move on. The question is about his leadership challenge. But to that point, to the deal, who won? Democrats are not gleeful. Chip Roy says they're gleeful. They're not gleeful. Progressives are not happy either. But if you look at the projected baseline of federal spending was at $757 billion. The House Republican bill demanded it drop to $689 billion. The compromise is $704 billion. So that's a true Washington compromise. Spending is going to go down less than it was going to be. Republicans say, McCarthy says, we only have the House. We have a Democratic president, Democratic Senate. That's a good deal for us. The Wall Street Journal editorial board agrees. The lesson is that political unity pays. Assuming the deal passes Congress, it will defy the Democratic narrative that Republicans can't govern. Mr. McCarthy's troops are proving they can, and conservatives would be foolish to abandon the victories in this deal. But but this is, again, the upside down world we live in. That's the Republican establishment. Mm-hmm. The 40 members you just saw there, I don't know if they all showed up, but the 40 member House Freedom Caucus, the Republican establishment says jump. They say no.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's like the opposite of what you want if you're a Chip Roy. You don't want to hear from a board like the Wall Street Journal editorial board. I was texting with another moderate House member this morning who said something interesting about kind of the messaging. We've all been talking about how the public messaging up until the point of the deal from Kevin McCarthy was pretty solid.
Right.
And in some ways, he had outsmarted the Biden White House. That certainly was coming from some Democrats I was talking to. But this member said perhaps his internal messaging to his members didn't lay the groundwork enough for the fact that he would have to make a deal that looks a lot like this. Would it have made a difference? Who knows with the conference that he has. But I thought that was an interesting note.
So we watch now, again, those conservatives voicing their outrage. Number one, the big test, 3 o'clock, the Rules Committee meets. Can McCarthy get this out of the committee, get it to the floor? He thinks he can. If he gets that done, then we follow it from there in the 24 to 48 hours ahead. Up next for us, though, the Russian capital getting a firsthand sense of war after an apparent drone attack. The Kremlin accusing Ukraine and issuing arrest warrants. Tonight, for the first time, the Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is in Iowa as an official presidential candidate. His event, courting Christian conservatives, opens a 12-city, 3-state swing for a candidate trying to make the case he's the only GOP contender who can beat Donald Trump. CNN's Jessica Dean is live for us in Des Moines, Iowa. A big test for the Florida governor now that he's officially in.
It certainly is, John, and a lot of eyes will be on here as he does officially kick off his campaign here in Iowa, a state that he said himself is critically important and is going to play a large role. And as we know, in covering presidential elections and campaigns, where candidates spend their time, where they choose to do big events like kick off their campaign, really matters and really tells you a lot. And so here he is in Iowa, which of course will be the first caucus for the GOP presidential primary. And we're going to see him going to an evangelical church to do so. And you mentioned this is important as well. He's going to be courting evangelicals here in Iowa and across the country who potentially have cooled on former President Donald Trump. They see that as potentially an in for them, a place where they can really create a foothold both here and, again, across the country. So that's where he will do that tonight. He'll then continue on through Iowa with several stops tomorrow before going to New Hampshire and South Carolina. But what is interesting, John, is that he ends the week on Saturday right back here where it all began in Iowa. He'll be here with Senator Joni Ernst for an event on Saturday with more Iowans, again, as they seek to really build this message out and pitch to voters why he should be the person to lead the Republican Party and go up against against President Joe Biden in 2024, why he is the alternative to Trump. We expect to hear more about his vision tonight. He's been here in Iowa several times leading up to all of this, but tonight we really are expecting to see a more crystallized speech about why he should be the person and what his vision is going forward. John.
Jessica Dean, busy week in Iowa. Appreciate your kicking us off from Des Moines. Yeah. Let's bring the conversation back in the room. And again, just put up the travels this week, if you could. Put the map back up. Most of the Republican candidates you see going to Iowa are going to that Joni Ernst event. There's not a debate until August, but they're all going to be at the same place. We'll see how much they interact there. Trump is not committed of the ones to go to that event. But you see that play out there. Let's have a conversation about Ron DeSantis. This in the Des Moines Register today caught our attention. Eric Wilson, who was a Scott Walker 2016 advisor, remember back then? There are a lot of pitfalls to being in the position that DeSantis is in right now. People have set very high expectations for him. Well, if he worked for Scott Walker, he ought to know something about high expectations and gravity. DeSantis is, he's been there before, so don't make too much of it. But his first official trip, Trump coming in right behind him, me, not all these other people, me. How does he do it?
Right. Well, he's doing it by appealing to the constituencies, like Jessica said, that he feels he can pluck off from the former president. He is appearing at a mega church in suburban Des Moines, clearly trying for that evangelical vote. He is traveling he's traveling throughout the state. And I do think it's really interesting how we were waiting to see how DeSantis would behave like a candidate once he was actually in. And his electability argument that he's making against the former president, we expected him to make that, particularly after how successful he's been in Florida. But I do think it's interesting how he's starting to make some policy differentials with him as well. We saw a lot of criticism from over the weekend on the First Step Act, which is that bipartisan criminal justice reform law that President Trump signed into law, one of the big bipartisan accomplishments of his presidency. Ron DeSantis called it a jailbreak bill. So that is a really interesting policy differential between the two. And I think you'll see more of that as we go on.
And you see clearly trying to get, let's DeSantis is trying to make the Republican race about policy, about ideology. You're laughing. I get it. Because Trump blew up the traditional Republican policy apparatus. But DeSantis is trying to get to his right. Trump apparently has noticed, though. This is Donald Trump today raising an issue he first brought up as president. If you're born in this country, you have what's called birthright citizenship. Donald Trump says shouldn't be that way.
As part of my plan to secure the border on day one, my new term in office, I will sign an executive order making clear to federal agencies that under the correct interpretation of the law, going forward, the future children of illegal aliens will not receive automatic U.S. citizenship. It's things like this that bring millions of people to our country.
All the Republicans need to call Carrie Lake's lighting guy.
Yeah.
Everyone, they keep posting these videos.
That was surprising.
They keep posting these videos of themselves or having events where they're in the dark. But that's proof to me that for all the Trump people saying DeSantis can't get us, that's proof again that they're worried about the right flank.
That's right. And listen, I mean, this sort of tough on immigration, tough on immigrants talk, evangelicals love that, right? I mean, he's got his eye on Iowa. He's got his eye on really having that base around him because he knows that people like Tim Scott and people like Ron DeSantis to a certain extent might be candidates who that base will like. I will say this. I mean, I sort of laughed at the whole idea of making this a policy debate because it is sort of laughable. I mean, we've seen this in the past, whether it was Hillary Clinton going up against Barack Obama, trying to make it a policy debate in 2008 rather than a sort of an energy and a feel debate. You've got Ron DeSantis basically trying to pass out his resume to voters. And that's not really how voters decide things. It's much more of a sort of a gut feeling. And we know, at least in the past, that's been about Trump.
No, but you make a key point and jump in on it. I use the Hillary Obama analogy today in the sense that once Obama proved, though, by beating her in Iowa, that he was legit, African-Americans in the later states who were in the Clinton camp said, sorry, we can't do this. You have to beat Trump. You have to beat the front runner.
Yeah.
You have to beat and bruise or beat the front runner to get people to give you a second thought. The question is, can Ron DeSantis do that in Iowa?
And he's also, remember, it's not, it is about trying to beat Trump, of course, but it's also about being the alternative to Trump. Because there are going to be a lot of people who are potential candidates for evangelicals, if we're just staying on that subject, in Iowa. I mean, you have Tim Scott.
Yep.
You have Mike Pence, potentially. You have others who are very much that kind of mold. And you also have, yes, it is still the whole question about whether Trump is going to get them back. But he definitely lost a lot of support from and with evangelicals towards the end of his presidency.
But I also think in some ways it's not enough to get the evangelicals, because there's always a sort of number two Republican, right? It was Ted Cruz last time. Yeah. It was Rick Santorum before. And those were people who did really well with the evangelical vote. So even if he wins Iowa, right? I mean, where else is he going to just win sort of all of those southern evangelical states in the way that Ted Cruz did?
And I just want to show the map of the full field. You have on the left side already in the race, the right side also considering Mike Pence is in there. Chris Christie's allies formed a super PAC. He's about to get in. That evangelicals are not his core constituency. But you have a crowded field, which a crowded field at the moment benefits Trump. One last point, and then you get the last word to your... So you mentioned Santorum, homeschoolers in Iowa.
Oh, my goodness.
Homeschoolers in Iowa. DeSantis appeared at a homeschooling convention in Florida on Friday. Watch it. Watch it. No, Santorum went from two to beating Mitt Romney with the homeschoolers.
Right, right. And you do see how... You do see how Governor DeSantis is trying to appeal to all the various different constituencies in Iowa. But going back to that point, I did think it was really interesting when Senator Scott got into the race. Donald Trump was actually very warm and welcoming of that. And I think it's because many things, but I think he also recognizes that the more people who are in this race, it benefits him. So I think he's really saying the more the merrier, water's fine, jump in.
Right. Field's going to get bigger this week. And then in the weeks ahead, the question is, when does it shrink, before Iowa or beyond? That's what Trump is watching closely. When we come back, a Democratic shift that should be a slam dunk for the Democrats. But instead, there's something else happening with Christian conservatives and with blue-collar voters. Closer look next. Demography is destiny is a line you hear often in politics, and it is a very good yet imperfect guide to predicting future political outcomes. The veteran political reporter Tom Edsel offers a thoughtful look at some current trends in the New York Times. This is striking. Look at the projected growth of millennials and younger generations as a percentage of the electorate over the next dozen years. Then consider this. Millennials, those between 27 and 42 years old, favor Democrats by 14 points in the 2022 midterms. Gen Z voters, those 18 to 26 years old, favored Democrats by a whopping 56 points last year. So demography favors the Democrats, without question. And that advantage will only grow unless Republicans can make significant inroads. But, important but, why hasn't that advantage helped Democrats more already? How did Donald Trump win in 2016, for example? Or why did Republicans win the House last year? Edsel explains it this way. The white backlash to the growing strength of liberal constituencies not only prompted conservative voters to back Republicans by higher margins, they also turned out to vote at exceptionally high rates. Tom Edsel is here to join our conversation. It's great to see you,
my old friend.
So explain the backlash. And I want to put up one other graphic as you do, because it's striking. The younger voters are growing in size. They're a bigger piece of the voting pie, and they disproportionately favor Democrats. And yet, Republicans are holding their own. Here's one reason why. Look at the evangelical voters. White non-college degree, Bush versus Trump. Donald Trump gets a way higher percentage, 12 points higher among white without a college degree. Among white evangelicals, George W. Bush gets 75%. Donald Trump gets 89%. This is the backlash you're talking about. Populations, whether it's blue-collar workers or religious voters, who feel somehow threatened.
What's going on? It's two steps, in a sense. Not only are young voters voting more for Democrats, but as they grow older, they're defying the basic rule of politics that the older you get, the more conservative you become. They're going in the opposite direction for the first time over the last three election cycles. So you see a rise in their Democratic margins and a rise in the degree that they turn out. The problem is, this sounds great for Democrats, is that white conservatives, evangelicals, white Catholics, are turning out way above their numbers. They're punching harder than they should. I think the figures for evangelicals is they're something like 14% of the population now, but they're 22% of the actual turnout. That's a huge difference.
But we can show that. We'll show that and continue the conversation. White evangelicals, 14% of the population, 22% of the voters in 2020. White Catholics, 12% of the population, 16% of the voters in 2020. It just tells you that you can look at the pie, and Democratic-leaning voters are a bigger slice of the pie, and yet there's always what I call the push-me-pull-you in demographics, and I mean Dr. Doolittle, not the video game, in the sense that, you know, one group starts to pull this way and another group says, well, I feel threatened, and they pull back.
Yeah. I mean, that's the question. Is it, Tom, do you feel in looking at the research and the data that it's, for lack of a better way to say it, wokeism? Is it because of what a lot of these people see on conservative media about the other coming in, that they're buying into that, or is it all of it?
Well, I think the real fear is that they think they're going to get extinguished by these growing numbers of liberal constituencies. The best way to turn out a vote is to get the person scared. The other best way is to get them angry. And what has happened is that leaders on the right have gotten their voters scared and angry. And the effect is that they're turning out in these higher and higher numbers. Their long-term problem is how much juice can you squeeze out of a lemon that's actually shrinking? And over time, this method of countering the liberal trend really runs into real problems as it hits this, it sort of maxes out, and you just can't get another drop out of that lemon.
Right. That's the great point. If you go back to the original graphic we had, millennials and younger generations, the majority of the electorate by 2028, that's the point you're making, in the sense that when you see Donald Trump's attack today on birthright citizenship, when you see the attacks on transgender Americans, when you see, you know, whether it's immigration, whether it's gay rights, it's these issues that you're playing to the base or trade and globalism, globalization. You're playing to blue-collar workers. You're playing to the evangelical voters. And yet, to Tom's point, how many times when 62% of the electorate in 2036 is going to be these younger voters, that song's not going to work anymore. Or as Bill Clinton would say, that dog won't hunt.
Right. But for now, it can hunt, right? I mean, we saw what happened in 2022 with the House. We obviously saw what happened in 2016. And Donald Trump is trying to make that dog hunt in 2024. He is the master of white grievance politics, the master of white identity politics. He knows what to say. He sort of knows. It's not even code words at this point. It's basically saying that brown people are going to come here and kill you, right? I mean, that was during his, when he announced his candidacy in 2016. I mean, that's essentially what he said. And so they'll play that over and over again. You see DeSantis doing the same thing. The idea, you know, that the woke mob, you know, is out to get you, but he's going to be the person to vanquish it. So it works. You know, it's worked in American politics quite well. We had, I think, Republicans not want to sort of play this game of white identity politics, but Donald Trump played it, and he played it masterfully.
And so part of the challenge for Republicans is, can somebody break the mold, if you will? You do have Nikki Haley, you have Tim Scott, you have Vivek Ramaswamy, you have Larry Elder, you do have voters of color, women in the Republican field. Do they try to practice a different kind of politics to widen the tent, expand the tent, or do they stay in that lane because Trump proved it can work?
Well, they have tried, at least by emphasizing their own identities, pointing to their own personal diversities to try to bring that factor to the Republican Party. But I'm really struck, especially with the growing percentage of younger voters that are favoring Democrats, just how little in terms of policy that Republicans have tried in reaching out to younger voters. I think the closest that you can get is perhaps some Republican elected officials embracing the science of climate change, saying this is something that we have to tackle, maybe not in the way that Democrats are proposing, but it is certainly a threat and we have to propose policies towards it. But you just kind of step back and they're not really appealing to younger voters in the way, with their policy platforms, with their proposals.
Where do you watch? We go back a long way. Michael Dukakis won West Virginia. Forget about it now, right? You know, Wisconsin, a state where Trump won, then lost. Where do you watch for sort of where's the tipping point in this demographic tug of war?
I think Wisconsin is an excellent state, actually, to look at. Pennsylvania is another. There are a lot of northern, Midwestern purple states where these tilts are just coming in. And you see what happens is in the states where they have a higher percentage of college-educated white voters, that's where the tipping point occurs. Right. And these voters are Democrats. Right. And that's where the Republicans really run into big problems.
I urge everyone, pick up the New York Times. It's a long, in-depth article. It's a lot It's a lot deeper than we can do on television, but Tom, appreciate you're here to help us tee it up. And coming up for us, an issue where President Biden and Senator Ted Cruz are, guess what, in total agreement. A global stage disgrace remarkably puts Joe Biden and Ted Cruz on the same page, both men condemning a new law in Uganda that makes homosexuality a capital offense in some cases and a crime worthy of a lifetime prison sentence in others. President Biden calling that measure, quote, a tragic violation. Senator Cruz says it is, quote, horrific and wrong. Our great reporters are back with us. I would frame this as a good thing. Mm-hmm. It is rare that we have bipartisan agreement on anything. But to have the conservative Texas senator and the Democratic president speaking out against this law is important. Does it get you anywhere?
You know, unclear. Listen, I mean, Ted Cruz hasn't always been on this side when you talk about gay rights, same-sex marriage, for instance. So for him to come out and say this is significant, it's a good thing. And, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, I think Republicans are in a place where they seem to be against LGBTQ people. If you look at some of the things that are going on in the different states. So I think for Ted Cruz to specifically come out about this law is good. It might be a good idea to also speak about some of the other things that are going on in this country that seem to be anti-LGBTQ. But listen, this is a good start.
Right. He picks his moments, if you will. You mentioned same-sex marriage. He believes it should be decided by the states. He also recently opened an investigation at Anheuser-Busch over the Dylan Mulvaney controversy. And so he picks his moments. But in the case of Uganda, life imprisonment for anyone convicted of homosexuality, death penalty for what the law calls aggravated homosexuality, 10 years in prison for attempting to have safe-sex relations. Unfortunately, 30 of the 54 countries in Africa, one way or another, penalize this.
Right. And the version that was signed into law is actually a less draconian version of a law that the legislature initially passed because of all this international pressure that you're seeing from the likes of President Joe Biden and Senator Ted Cruz. And you do have, it's not only politicians speaking out, you have the UN, you have global AIDS programs talking about the really awful impact that this would have on the people in Uganda. And it is, in that context that you just mentioned there, what is important to keep in mind that in the 54 countries in Africa, 30 criminalize homosexuality in some respects. So you do see how, you know, essential human rights is really curbed in the continent.
Yeah, and we also, this is Inside Politics, so let's keep in mind not just the politics of strange bedfellows with Cruz and Biden, but also the fact that Cruz is on the ballot this year. And whether or not, okay, maybe this is just one of those situations where he truly believes that this is bad. The other thing is that we have to keep in mind, though, is that he, just like most senators and most members, when they're thinking about the ballot, where does this put me? Maybe this is a place where he feels like it's sort of firm, you know, terra firma on an issue where he can argue against this internationally and maybe not do so domestically.
All right. We'll see if the pressure does any good, brings any changes. Up next, first, the Treasury Department running low on cash. Some of the world's richest people wouldn't even worry about it. Topping our political radar today, the House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, says he is prepared to hold the FBI director, Christopher Wray, in contempt of Congress if Wray misses a subpoena deadline today to turn over an internal FBI document from a whistleblower. That document alleges Vice President Biden was involved in a quid pro quo with a foreign country.
I personally called Director Wray and told him he needs to send that document. Today is the deadline. Tell Director Christopher Wray right here, right now. If he misses the deadline today, I am prepared to move contempt charges in Congress against him.
This must be nice. 31 billionaires, each worth more than the Treasury Department has on hand in cash at the moment. That's about $38.8 billion. Among them, Michael Dell, Warren Buffett, Facebook founder, co-founder, Mark Zuckerberg. Some of them are worth a lot more, like the fashion mogul Bernard Arnault, $993 billion. The Tesla billionaire Elon Musk, $185 billion. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, net worth of $144 billion. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for your time. CNN News Central starts right now.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.